Spurs in full cry here. Let it
Welcome, listeners, to The Extra Inch. My name's Windy, and I'm joined by Alex Stoyle, a sports psychologist who I cannot wait to talk to about all things sports psychology. Alex, how the devil are you?
I'm good, thank you, Chris. How are you?
I'm really well, and I'm really, really looking forward to our chat. Let's start off by talking about your credentials, firstly as a sports psychologist and secondly as a Spurs fan. So you are a PhD candidate doing a professional doctorate in sport and exercise psychology.
Yeah, that's correct. So doing that down at the University of Portsmouth, although obviously given the situation at the moment, I'm actually not there very much of the time. I'm London based and doing remotely. And I have just come, I've got a master's in sports and exercise psychology and a master's in general psychology as well. And I'm currently doing that professional doctorate, which is between a sort of 3 and 6 year path to becoming a fully qualified sports and exercise psychologist. Along the way, I do sort of supervised training, and I'm my sort of area of research within that is around sort of choking and performance under pressure. So in other words, bottling it, and potentially we can, you could maybe draw some conclusions about my lifetime of being a Spurs fan and my desire to go into the subject of choking under pressure. So far, none of my research has actually included the word Spursy, but we should see. There's a long way to go. So
a one word thesis title, probably the first ever one word thesis title, just Spursy.
Yeah, exactly.
So that was a beautiful segue. So talk about your Spurs fandom, Alex.
Yeah, so I've been a Spurs fan, since my sort of early teenage years. My dad was actually was from Plymouth, so he was an Argyle fan. But I was raised in London, so that was kind of would have been cruel and unusual punishment in many ways, not least that home games would have been a sort of 4 or 5 hour drive away. And so sort of started following Spurs actually through kind of a bit of good luck. My mum actually won some tickets in a work raffle to go and watch Spurs. So my first game was Spurs against Leeds back when I was about 13, I think. Which kind of shows how old I am that, it was back when Leeds were up in the Premier League before this time around. Now I'm a season ticket holder. Can't wait to get back into the stadium once that's possible, which it's looking more and more likely that might be coming soon, which is excellent news.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it has been particularly tough on season ticket holders, this, isn't it? Because it's such a part of your routine in life. Alex, let's get straight into it. There's so much to talk about, but I think firstly, if you could give us a grounding in sports psychology and some of the background theory, particularly in relation, I think, to your thesis. But firstly, we've had a bit of a back and forth. We've had a conversation before this, and there's lots of interesting things have already come up that just wouldn't have occurred to me before I spoke to you. Firstly, you mentioned that people tend to see psychology as fixing weaknesses, when actually it can be just as much about developing strengths.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, as you said, that's probably quite a sort of common misconception about what sports psychology is. And potentially, that's true of the sort of broader mental health, mental well-being kind of concept that, across not just in sport. A lot of what we do, it might be about sort of identifying areas that aren't particularly strong and then trying to improve those. But certainly there's a whole realm of sort of positive psychology, which is about identifying strengths, super strengths, either kind of individually or within a team, and trying to sort of use those as a way of kind of, to enhance those and actually sort of increase confidence, increase motivation, and improve performance. A lot of what we do kind of tries to find a balance between those. And of course, it's not a sort of either or situation, right? So, you know, if you're working with a team or working with an individual, there'll be a bit of both. You know, sometimes you'll be working on an area that they maybe consider a bit of a weakness, and sometimes you'll be, you know, building up those strengths even more.
Interesting. And we spoke about the concept of efficacy in individual and team performance. Now, you mainly have expertise in individual performance, but you've got some sort of background research in team performance as well. Is that right?
Yeah. So my specific research on choking is more kind of targeted on individuals, kind of individual sports. That's largely just because, you know, as you can kind of imagine, if you're trying to decide whether someone has had, you know, a bad performance because of pressure, it's a bit easier if they're just one person. Trying to determine, you know, whether one player in a team of 11 has choked or not is really difficult, because their performance is going to be so dependent not just on themselves but on their teammates, and also obviously on the opposition, you know. And I guess kind of for me, like a classic example of that might be like the Ajax, you know, game in the Champions League, right? Like, would you say, was that an amazing comeback by Spurs in the second half, or was that, you know, Ajax choking or bottling it, whatever term you want to use, you know? But then also, if you try to then pick out individual Ajax players to say like, oh, he choked but he didn't or whatever, you know, that would be very, very complex as a sort of kind of a design for some research. So generally, I like to look a bit more, at least for now, in those kind of individual sports, just because it helps sort of clarify that. Mm-hmm. But within that, you know, there are certainly some sort of concepts that would be, you know, are applicable to, you know, any athlete, whether you're talking individual sport or team sport, that sort of come back to sort of ideas around, you mentioned the word efficacy there. So efficacy is a sort of fancy word for kind of self-confidence that we use in sports psychology. And that's really an idea. It's slightly more nuanced than self-confidence. It's basically a confidence that you can do the processes, you can execute the bits and pieces that will give you the result or the performance that you're looking for. And that's definitely a theme that will come up a lot, is about sort of breaking down performances into the sort of constituent parts, the components. Another sort of very common theme within the work that I do is an idea, a technical term called reinvestment. And that's basically an idea that, you know, and for kind of for a decent example is sort of imagining yourself as a learner driver. When you're learning a new skill, right, if you're driving a manual car and you're trying to remember to engage, you know, you just want to change gears, right? And that sounds easy enough when you say it as an experienced driver, but when you're 17 or whatever and you're trying to remember to engage your left foot, then you've got to move the gear stick from here to there, and then you've got to engage the pedal, you know, the accelerator, and then you've got a you know, it's really complicated set of different movements involving all your different limbs, and you're still meant to be checking the mirrors and all the rest of it. But eventually that becomes an automatic process. And reinvestment is a technical term for basically when the opposite happens. So it's, you know, if all of a sudden you're sitting there and someone were actually to say to you, oh, what processes do you go through when you change gears? And you actually have to think about it for a second rather than just doing it in that sort of like natural automatic way. It can become really hard, and you can kind of actually start to overthink it. And all of a sudden you know, your gears are grinding or you've stalled out at the lights or whatever. So and the same thing can happen with any sort of sporting skill as well. So it's the idea that actually in certain moments, a skill that, you know, a player would be able to do automatically, under most circumstances, they actually are unable to do it. And there seems to be a relationship between that reinvestment happening and sort of moments of extreme pressure where, you know, obviously in that moment, they're desperate to do it well. And so they actually start to pay more attention, in fact, too much attention to the movements that they're doing. So rather than just sort of sweeping the ball into the back of the net like they normally would be able to, they're like, OK, right, I've got to think about this. I've got to get it right. I've got to beat the keeper. Where am I going to put it? And that causes that little breakdown of that kind of automatic execution.
That's so interesting. In fact, yesterday I was having a conversation with someone about the concept of flow. And we were debating whether that is a thing. he said that it is a term that gets misused. But my understanding of flow is that it's when you are in a state of mind where things are happening in such a sort of unthinking way. You are in the zone, as it were. That's a sort of colloquial way of putting it. And you're able to, like you said, with driving, you can do it without thinking. You don't engage your brain. but you're being really productive. You're being all creative. You're in the zone, so your flow is in full flow. And my friend that I was speaking to said, no, this is not really a thing. In fact, I can't remember the reasons why he said it wasn't, but he disagreed with the entire concept. But what you've just described there sounds like you're trying to take someone from a sort of overthinking mechanical. It's a bit like when you think too much about your breathing, suddenly you can't breathe properly. And I'm sure, having just said that, people now have problems breathing, because it's such a weird thing that the second you start to focus on it, it becomes unnatural. And trying to then take someone back into the zone must be really difficult.
Yeah, absolutely. And I will say, between you and your friend have stumbled on an area of research. So there is specific research into flow as a concept. I'm not super familiar with all of the sort of nuances of it, but I know that there are many different sort of and quite kind of long and detailed different definitions of what flow might be.
I think that's where we were coming across terms, because we were both defining it in slightly different ways. That was the problem.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, it's, and you know, I think actually that also sort of touches on an interesting point in that more broadly across sports psychology and probably across a lot of other psychology is, yeah, you know, if you've got slightly differing definitions of a concept, because you're trying to nail down these really quite complex, potentially quite subjective experiences. Mm-hmm. In sports psychology, you're also talking, you're trying to generalize across multiple sports, but obviously the characteristics of those are hugely different, you know, the super simplistic way of sort of team versus individual. But I mean, the difference in a competitive environment between a swimmer and a boxer, right? Those are both individual sports, but those have very different pressures and psychological challenges. Yeah. and all the rest of it. So, so coming up with a good, solid, universally agreed upon definition for some of these quite complicated concepts is a really tricky challenge. And then also the other challenge beyond that is then how do you measure that, right? So that's a whole other sort of topic. Is okay, right, congratulations, like we think we've now defined, let's say, flow or defined choking, but now how do we sort of determine whether someone is in the flow? Can we just do that by watching video footage of them? Do we have to interview them? A lot of psychology, including sports psychology, loves to use sort of questionnaires. So can we formulate a really sort of hopefully simple but comprehensive enough way of sort of getting someone to kind of say, oh yeah, I'm not answering these 20 questions, and from that we can deduce whether they were in the zone or not. There's lots of different avenues of research into all of these sort of separate kind of subtopics, whether that's flow state or choking, or actually similar to sort of flow but kind of slightly different is the idea of thriving as well. So which is kind of seen as maybe the opposite in some senses of choking, that you can either choke under pressure or you can thrive under pressure. So what are the differences there? Why might one person be more likely to choke and go to pieces? Why would someone else really thrive under it? And you can definitely think of lots of sports people who maybe fall into one of those categories or the other, right? And some people who've fallen into both at various points in their career. A lot of the most extreme examples of choking, thinking of my own research, is people who are usually very, very good, very reliable, best in the world. It's when they have a shocker that it's most obvious, potentially to a kind of an external observer as a sort of sports fan. Those are the people you can go, oh wow, something was really wrong there.
So interesting. I think we should talk a little bit about how psychology is used in football, and I want to come back to the idea of building resilience and some of your research as well. But just to sort of give us a baseline. And I think it's useful starting at academy level, because we had an interesting conversation about this pre-record. How do clubs use some of this stuff?
Yeah, so I mean, I think at academy level, all category one academies, and Tottenham's academy is category one, it's one of the best in the country, and all of those have to have a sports psychologist on staff. That should mean that every single person who's come out of that Tottenham Academy in the last few years, which there are a few, a good number of those, that they should all have some, at least a kind of relatively kind of basic foundation in some of the sort of core sports psychology concepts, as well as sort of some tips and tricks, some of the sort of more fundamental tools that we use, that we can talk a bit about, in a bit. But what I guess is also sort of interesting there, and I definitely don't want to suggest that this is happening at Tottenham or even at any academy, but there is always a bit of a risk when you've got, these hyper competitive environments. And if you've got, as I said, lots of these questionnaires that can kind of essentially measure certain psychological characteristics, right? If you've got 20 kids for every one place in the next, next year above, or, trying to make it from the under 16s to the under 18s, there is potential, there is a risk that those, rather than administering those tests and sort of seeing that as an opportunity to improve that player, that young person's, whether it's resilience or their confidence or, their ability to sort of handle, competitive anxiety or whatever, rather than sort of seeing that as an opportunity to improve them, you might actually just screen them out. You might just sort of say like, oh, well, they've not got what it takes. That's a good enough reason to ditch them at this point. And I suspect there's probably similar arguments in any number of aspects of their performance, not just the psychological ones, that probably is also happening at academy level, right? You have to make a determination about who progresses through the system or not. Mm-hmm. But I think that also just sort of speaks to a much broader point that, sports psychology is like any other sporting skill or collection of skills. It is something that can be improved, it can be developed, strengthened, so in the same way that you might look at a young player and go like, oh well, their first touch isn't what it should be, but we can work on that, we've got drills, we can coach that, or their positioning or whatever it happens to be, the same can be done with psychological aspects of their game as well. So I think that's just sort of an interesting point. Like I said, I don't want to suggest that's widespread, but there is, I think people are concerned that it could be used, for those purposes.
It's a really interesting point. I I think we're all guilty at sometimes of just assuming a player is a player and they're fixed and that's them forever. And not just in terms of psychology, but in terms of any attributes. And I've been guilty of that in the past many times, that just assuming that a player can't be improved. And it's such a sad way to view a player. I mean, a player should be seen as coachable in all elements of their game. And you see this phrase weak mentality thrown around about players. That player's got a weak mentality, he'll never be elite, that sort of thing. Or even worse than that, sort of smears about their personality. I remember Marcus Edwards had so much smearing of his personality across the board, and people just assumed that he wouldn't make it as a pro. He'd go down the route of Ravel Morrison, who's a player that is mm-hmm. often held up as the wrong way to be as a footballer. And I think there's some, that's probably a fair comment in many ways, but it's not fair to compare players in that way. And you should see, look at Marcus Edwards now, look what he's doing in Portugal. He's having another fantastic start to the season, and clearly wasn't a lost cause. He just needed some support and some changes to be made, and now it's working. So I do think it's a really interesting point about thinking too much about players just being what they are and not thinking about their potential. And I presume that's quite a lot of what sports psychology is about. It's about unlocking potential, and that will be ultimately what your job will be in the future.
Yeah, and I think one really important point, talking particularly about those sort of younger players and academy players and whatever, is to bear in mind that, just like the physical body, the brain develops, and it develops at different rates from one person to another, right? So in the same way that you might have a 13-year-old who's 6'2", but another person might not grow until they're 17 or whatever, you might miss out on an opportunity for a good player if you just kind of judge them at the age of 16 and kick them out because one's not tall enough. But that, the brain development can be quite different, right? So you might look at someone and they might be sort of physically mature, have all their sort of, kind of full grown kind of strength and attributes and all the rest of it. But the brain can take up until the mid 20s to fully develop. And, so when you're talking about, you know, and when you think about that, I mean, we're recording this the day after the Ludogorets game when, you know, we had, I think by the end, you know, there were only kind of three players on the pitch who were over the age of 25, right? So that means that the vast majority of players on that, on for the team there, they'd have all been potentially, none of them would have a fully developed brain, you know, adult brain. And there are, you know, that's not to say that there are sort of anything wrong or, you know, any kind of sort of detriments or anything that's wrong with that kind of adolescent brain, but it does just sort of function slightly differently, and that's really important as well. So one of the things that's kind of particularly acute or kind of important in adolescence, and I think a lot of people can probably sort of reflect on this in their own experiences, but is your place among your peers suddenly gains huge amounts of importance. So all of a sudden, you know, when you think from a coaching perspective what that might mean, it's sort of things like, you know, if you call them out publicly and that embarrasses them in front of their peers, in front of their friends, that will probably be more hurtful than, you know, and more demotivating, you know, all of the sort of negative side effects that might come from that are probably going to be more acute in someone who's still in that sort of adolescent brain stage. And when you think about potentially some of the things that happened with some of these younger players as they come up and they maybe get a little bit of limelight early on, then, you know, managers or press or fans or whatever turn on them when they don't immediately become, you know, Lionel Messi overnight, right? And there was a Messi comparison, I think, with Marcus Edwards, which was, potentially unhelpful amounts of pressure. But, you know, when they don't immediately, you know, win the Ballon d'Or the next year, fans turn on them. And that, if you're, you know, that's going to be hard for any player at any stage of their career, I'm sure. But, you know, particularly in that point where you're kind of really craving that acceptance from teammates, from peers, from friends, you know, finding your place in the sort of the pecking order, that's really, going to be pretty unhelpful. So I think that's just sort of something to bear in mind. And as I said, you know, we tend to look at sports, any kind of sports people, but, you know, particularly footballers, we kind of just assume that they're all the same. Which, you know, and we tend to sort of treat them in a slightly inhuman way. We tend to assume they don't really have thoughts and feelings. Yeah. But of course they do. But also that, you know, I think, as you said, we tend to kind of assume that they are quite sort of set in stone, which just may not be the case. You know, even established players in the Premier League, if they're still only 23, 24, 25, they still may not be fully kind of developed and into that sort of adult brain state.
And what you're describing is really complex, and Spurs have got a large squad. Many Premier League teams have got large squads, and this must be tremendous work for all the staff at the club. Do you get a feel for how many psychologists there are at Premier League clubs? Do you have any information on that, or is it not really transparent?
So it's not very transparent. My understanding is I don't have any direct sort of connections at Tottenham. I don't believe they have a full-time psychologist working with the senior team. So they'll definitely have someone working with the academy, but they won't. But to my knowledge, they don't have anyone with the senior team. That's not to say that they don't potentially have, you know, people come in on a sort of consultant basis to talk to the team. It's also entirely possible that on an individual level, some of those players have sort of sought psychological support elsewhere, you know, basically sort of out of pocket, off their own back. But as far as I'm aware, there's no one there. There certainly are other Premier League teams that do. I think, you know, in recent episodes, there's been a lot of talk from you guys about, you know, why would a Premier League team not have a set piece specialist coach? I mean, I sit here from exactly the same perspective. I'm like, there are such minute details that can transform a season. Why would you not have a sports psychologist on staff who could just be there to help, you know, working both on a team level, you know, so a lot of what I do is giving workshops to whole teams, you know, just trying to sort of build up a bit of a kind of, you know, some of the more basic fundamental tools and techniques, but, you know, also there just to sort of help out individual players, whether that's, you know, on a ongoing basis where they pop in every week for a set appointment or just to be there and sort of listen. And I think, you know, coming back to sort of what sports psychology is and does is it's quite the way that I always frame it when I'm sort of first working with a client is that, you know, I am their ally and I'm on their side, you know, so I will very much listen to their side of the story. And I think one of the things that's often perhaps overlooked is that, you know, people can perceive a given situation in very different ways, right? So if a player feels like they are being picked on or singled out or whatever, even if the coach doesn't feel that way, that in some senses, what the coach thinks of that situation is irrelevant to that player. That player feels singled out, feels picked on, you know, that's going to lead to a sense potentially of feeling kind of demotivated, unappreciated. They're going to start wondering whether it's the right club for them, the right manager, whether they should be moving on. These questions start to sort of seep in. You know, that is the sort of ultimately that's the kind of the most important thing for that player, rather than whether or not the coach actually said something that was particularly offensive or rude or whatever.
Yeah, it's really interesting. So it's, I'm fascinated in the idea of Spurs not having psychologists. And you're right. One of my takeaways from the All or Nothing documentary was, why don't we just have a team of psychologists who are literally in the dressing room before every game, helping with some of the messaging? Because I did feel the players were getting mixed messages from the coaching staff at times. And I think it's really important to say at this point and caveat it by saying that we only saw snippets. It was very heavily edited. You know, we were bemoaning the fact that we didn't get to see tactical instruction, but I'm sure there was sort of psychological elements as well that we missed out on. And so you're stuck, or rather you're left analysing the fragments that are there. And perhaps it doesn't always show the coaching staff in the best possible light. But there must be a reliance then on the coaching staff having, I guess, training, perhaps they have training or just some knowledge of sports psychology more generally. Do you get a feeling as to whether coaches and managers know what they're doing in this respect?
So I think that's a good question. And obviously, I think it kind of varies from manager to manager. And your caveat is an important one that, you know, even, you know, we very rarely see the whole story. You know, the documentary was a really interesting insight to some aspects of life at Tottenham, but an awful lot was left on the cutting room floor, I'm sure, and edited out. But yeah, I think it is interesting, and certainly sort of seeing what we did see was an interesting kind of perspective. I was surprised that there wasn't more of a kind of that there was no evidence of a sports psychologist kind of working with the team, although there are potentially some confidentiality issues there. True. Right, you wouldn't, you know, we are kind of bound by confidentiality, so that probably would have been the only room potentially that didn't have the sort of fly on the wall camera in. But I think, yeah, you know, more generally, some of those team talks and kind of thinking about some of the topics that you guys spoke about, you know, in some of the watch along episodes of the podcast that you did. But I also sort of picked up on some of those points around just sort of for me, the biggest question was around sort of making some of the sort of the talk a bit more clearly defined. And potentially that's similar to the ideas you had around sort of the lack of tactical instruction. Maybe there was more instruction, we just weren't seeing it. But, you know, terms like just sort of going out and being aggressive, you know, being passionate, these terms are kind of quite ill-defined. They're very vague. And one of the things that, you know, I think really at the core of almost all sports psychology is an idea of control. So what can you control? And one of the easiest ways to think about this is to sort of, you can imagine everything in your life falls into three circles. In the middle of that is things you can directly control. So as a sports person, that's sort of turning up to training on time, making sure you're working hard, making sure you're doing all of the strength and conditioning, flexibility, rehab, nutrition, hydration, all of that kind of stuff. Then one level out from that are things you can influence. So you can kind of maybe move things in a certain direction, but you can't directly control them. And so things like squad selection probably fall in that. You can try and, you know, put on, you know, do the things that the coach has asked you to, have a good relationship with them so that you hope that you get selected. But ultimately, that's the manager's decision. You can't change their mind. And then beyond that, there are things that you have no control over. And what's really important is sort of thinking about the aspects of that, you know, when you're sort of talking about setting goals and giving objectives or instructions to a team, is like trying to think about which bits of those fall within each of those different circles, and trying to sort of make sure that everyone is clear about what that means. And I think that was the thing that was sort of most, I guess, sort of a bit surprising to me, is using these very sort of vague, potentially very motivating phrases, but they're quite vague, right? And so going out and just being aggressive, I mean, does that mean he wants every match to be the Battle of the Bridge, you know, where we're going to pick up a dozen yellow cards and, you know, run the risk of being down to 8 men by the final whistle and totally lose our heads? You assume not, right? Because that doesn't feel like a good way to win matches and win a league. So what does he mean by it? And I guess maybe over the course of the documentary, you kind of get a bit more insight into that. He starts sort of talking about sort of like intelligent bastards and kind of phrases like that. So he's trying to sort of add a bit of nuance to it, but it's still quite ill-defined. And one of the sort of really, you know, the most simple kind of go-to tools that sports psychologists use, and it's one that is kind of out there in the wider world as well, is, you know, when you are setting goals, is this kind of the SMART goal concept, which has definitely crept into lots of kind of other areas of life. It's sort of broken into kind of corporate world and all the rest of it as well. But you know, one of the kind of key tenets of that is sort of making sure that your goals are sort of, so SMART is specific, measurable, achievable, relevant, and time bound, right? And specific and measurable, right? Like, how are you going to specifically define aggressive, or specifically define playing with big balls, or, you know, being an intelligent bastard? Let alone, how do you measure it? How do you know that you played a certain game as an intelligent bastard or not? And as a player, you know, on a day-to-day basis, you want to be able to sort of look back and know that you've achieved those things, right? That's why you set goals, is that you can, they keep you motivated in the meantime, and then afterwards you can look back and you get a sense of achievement spurs you on to keep, to maintain that focus and maintain that motivation. So coming off the pitch and going, well, I think I played like an intelligent bastard, but I don't know for sure, that's, you know, that can be quite a tricky thing as a player, if you're sort of trying to gauge that and trying to sort of derive a sense of motivation from it.
It's really interesting. And I think what you're saying is right, that it could be motivational to players, but there's an element where if a little bit more was put in there, it could be so much more. It could be disproportionately having a positive impact, right? And there's a couple of other things I just want to pick up on briefly, Alex, around the all or nothing stuff. Now, I wasn't intending to do a deep dive into all or nothing, but this is fascinating me, so why not? This idea that Mourinho, one of his mantras was, we need to cope with the pressure or cope with the situation we're in. Is that something that seemed like quite an unusual turn of phrase to me. It didn't seem like a sort of proper football man thing. Is that something from the world of psychology?
Yeah, so coping is definitely a sort of sports psychology concept. And you know, one of the ways of sort of thinking about, you know, whether you have the ability to cope with a certain situation is, you know, there's almost like a sort of a formula. It's kind of past experiences where you may have dealt with something similar, or at least something similar enough that you can kind of transfer it, but also a belief in yourself that you have the tools in that moment, so that you have the resources on hand. So past experiences and the resources you have available to get through whatever situation you have in the moment. And coming back to the idea of efficacy that we sort of spoke briefly about earlier, like efficacy really plays into this. So that's the idea of this sort of self-confidence. And one of the bits, the research around efficacy has really shown that focusing on sort of positive outcomes is really helpful in those moments. So, you know, there's a moment in the documentary where, you know, Mourinho puts up a video of all of the goals that the team have conceded. And, you know, another important caveat, I've won precisely zero major footballing tournaments. You know, I've never won a league. So clearly Jose has an awful lot of experience and an awful lot of success behind him. But to me, that feels like potentially the opposite of what I, as the sports psychologist, would have been suggesting doing. You know, that potentially, if you're, you know, if what you want to do is you want to sort of talk to a team and you want to say, like, listen, we're going to work on closing out games, you know, what you would do is you would potentially show them footage of games where we had successfully done that, you know. And yes, it's very easy to go, yeah, but it's Spurs, that never happens, we're bottle jobs, whatever. But, you know, that's not true. You know, we held on against Man City in the Champions League a couple of seasons ago. Like, we have had games where we have been really under the cosh, we've been under sustained pressure, and we have got the result we wanted. Show footage of that, and that will give the team a bit of a sense of, like, yeah, actually, you know what, we have had games where we've come through. We have those past experiences to draw on that suggest we will be able to cope under pressure in a similar situation in the future. And I think one of the other sort of potentially interesting angles just around sort of the way Mourinho kind of arrives at the club is, you know, basically the first thing he sort of starts saying is, like, you guys are too nice. And there's a pretty, he doesn't explicitly say it, but there's a pretty clear kind of message if you read between the lines of, like, and that's why you haven't won anything. You know, you're too nice to close out games. You're too nice to sort of kill off opposition. And I guess if I had been the sports psychologist working at Tottenham for, you know, prior to that, I would have been doing an awful lot of work in trying to essentially sort of remove the Spursy label. And I suspect that's what the players have been doing, you know, previously, right? Getting ever closer to winning major competitions and trophies and all the rest of it, but not quite making it. But you would try and shake off that label. You would try and find the evidence to suggest that you're not Spursy. You're just, you know, you're getting there. It's a process, and you've just not quite reached the destination. A project was, you know, how Poch, you know, almost always referred to it, right? And coming in and sort of almost confirming the label of Spursiness certainly felt very high risk to me, because you've probably got players, you know, the longer standing players who've been in that dressing room for a long time will have been doing a lot to try and essentially discredit the idea that they are Spursy. And then you get Jose Mourinho, one of the most successful coaches in world football, comes in and goes, well, your problem is you're very Spursy. It's kind of not the most helpful way of shaking off that attitude. Again, worth mentioning, I've won precisely zero trophies, but it certainly seems like something that might cause a little bit, certainly, of a step back. And I don't know whether, you know, if you were being particularly speculative, you could maybe say, like, maybe that's why we didn't have particularly great performances. And there were certainly some performances we seemed to sort of throw away in those, you know, early games where Mourinho was in charge, you know. But, you know, I think there were potentially ways of kind of framing a message along those lines, but framing them in a more positive way. And again, that's a sort of a really core concept in sports psychology, you know, from very basic things of, you know, if you're talking about, you know, if there's a certain bit of technique that you want to improve, is, you know, framing it more like, if you do this, you will see this benefit, rather than you currently do that and that's why you make that mistake. Yeah. And at the very core of that is, I mean, you know, the sort of classic example is the sort of, you know, if I say, don't think of the pink elephant, the first thing that happens is you think of a pink elephant, right? So if I say, don't miss, you think, oh God, what if I miss? And so, you know, even sort of instructions of kind of like, you know, when telling kind of, you know, coaching people to sort of focus on penalties, you know, that they will think more about sort of like, okay, think about putting it in the top corner, or, you know, just tucking it inside the post or whatever, rather than trying to frame that as just make sure you don't put it outside, you know, or just, you know, make sure you don't miss the target. All of a sudden you've put that negative thought front and center. And, you know, that works on both that kind of micro level of sort of in that moment, but it also can work kind of longer term, you know, if you're sort of constantly reminding people of the sort of, this is the negative thing I don't want you to be anymore, that can actually sort of almost backfire.
And I guess all players will have different thresholds with how much this will affect their games as well. It's not going to be, some players will be a lot more naturally resilient than others, so wouldn't be necessarily undermined by particular use of language. That was really interesting, Alex.
You've been listening to The Extra Inch. Thanks to Nathan A. Clark for production. Thanks to Bardi for being Italian. Thanks to Adam Gardner for the artwork. Thanks to David Lindmer for our intro music. You can find him on Twitter at Davey Shambles and his SoundCloud E. Lindmer. Do check him out, he's great. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at The Extra Inch. Email us via podcast@theextrainch.co.uk and subscribe via your usual podcast platforms. And if you do enjoy the podcast, consider leaving us a rating and review. That would really help.